Chapter 6. "Bless my soul," he exclaimed again under his breath. All that afternoon he wore a dreamy, contemplative appearance which in him was a mark of perplexity. After dinner I went into my stateroom, as if I meant to take some rest. There we two bent our dark heads over a half-unrolled chart lying on my bed. "There," I said. "T's got to be Koh-ring. I've been looking at it ever since sunrise. It has got two hills and a low point. It must be inhabited. And on the coast opposite there is what looks like the mouth of a biggish river with some towns, no doubt, not far up. It's the best chance for you, that I can see. Anything. Koh-ring let it be." He looked thoughtfully at the chart, as if surveying chances and distances from a lofty height and following with his eyes his own figure wandering on the blank land of Cochin China, and then passing off that piece of paper clean out of sight into uncharted regions. And it was as if the ship had two captains, to plan her course for her. I had been so worried and restless running up and down that I had not had the patience to dress that day. I had remained in my sleeping suit, with straw slippers and a soft floppy hat. The closeness of the heat in the Gulf had been most oppressive, and the crew were used to seeing me wandering in that area attire. "She will clear the south point as she heads now," I whispered into his ear. "Goodness only knows when, though, but certainly after dark. I let her into half a mile, as far as I may be able to judge in the dark. Be careful," he murmured warningly, and I realized suddenly that all my future, the only future for which I was fit, would perhaps go irretrievably to pieces in any mishap to my first command. I could not stop a moment longer in the room. I motioned him to get out of sight, and made my way on the poop. That unplayful cub had the watch. I walked up and down for a while thinking things out, then beckoned him over. "Send a couple of hands to open the two quarter-deck ports," I said, mildly. He actually had the impudence, or else so forgot himself in his wonder at such an incomprehensible order, as to repeat. "Open the quarter-deck ports. What for, sir? The only reason you need concern yourself about is because I tell you to do so. Have them open wide and fastened properly." He reddened and went off, but I believe made some jeering remark to the carpenter, as to the sensible practice of ventilating a ship's quarter deck. I know he popped into the mate's cabin to impart the fact to him, because the whiskers came on deck, as it were by chance, and stole glances at me from below for signs of lunacy or drunkenness, I suppose. A little before supper, feeling more restless than ever, I rejoined, for a moment, my second self. And to find him sitting so quietly was surprising, like something against nature, inhuman. I developed my plan in a hurried whisper. "I shall stand in as close as I dare, and then put around. I will presently find means to smuggle you out of here into the sail locker, which communicates with the lobby. But there is an opening, a sort of square for hauling the sails out, which gives straight on the quarter deck, and which is never closed in fine weather, so as to give air to the sails. When the ship's way is deadened in stays, and all the hands are aft at the main braces, you will have a clear road to slip out, and get overboard through the open quarter deck port. I've had them both fastened up. Use a rope's end to lower yourself into the water so as to avoid a splash, you know. It could be heard, and cause some beastly complication." He kept silent for a while, then whispered, "I understand." "I won't be there to see you go," I began with an effort. "The rest. I only hope I have understood to." "You have. From first to last, and for the first time there seemed to be a faltering, something strained in his whisper. He caught hold of my arm, but the ringing of the supper bell made me start. He didn't though, he only released his grip. After supper I didn't come below again till well past 8 o'clock. The faint, steady breeze was loaded with dew, and the wet, darkened sails held all there was of propelling power in it. The night, clear and starry, sparkled darkly, and the opaque, lightless patches shifting slowly against the low stars were the drifting islets. On the portbo there was a big one more distant, and shadowily imposing by the great space of sky it eclipsed. On opening the door I had a back view of my very own self looking at a chart. He had come out of the recess, and was standing near the table. Quite dark enough, I whispered. He stepped back and leaned against my bed with a level, quiet glance. I sat on the couch. We had nothing to say to each other. Over our heads the officer of the watch moved here and there. Then I heard him move quickly. I knew what that meant. He was making for the companion, and presently his voice was outside my door. We are drawing in pretty fast, sir. Land looks rather close. Very well, I answered. I'm coming on deck directly. I waited till he was gone out of the cuddy, then rose. My double moved too. The time had come to exchange our last whispers, for neither of us was ever to hear each other's natural voice. Look here. I opened a drawer, and took out 3 sovereigns. Take this anyhow. I've got 6, and I'd give you the lot, only I must keep a little money, to buy some fruit and vegetables for the crew from native boats as we go through Sunda Straits. He shook his head. Take it, I urged him, whispering desperately. No one can tell what, he smiled, and slapped meaningly the only pocket of the sleeping jacket. It was not safe, certainly. But I produced a large old silk handkerchief of mine, and tying the 3 pieces of gold in a corner, pressed it on him. He was touched, I supposed, because he took it at last, and tied it quickly round his waist under the jacket, on his bare skin. Our eyes met. Several seconds elapsed, till, our glances still mingled, I extended my hand, and turned the lamp out. Then I passed through the cuddy, leaving the door of my room wide open. Steward. He was still lingering in the pantry in the greatness of his zeal, giving a rub up to a plated cruet stand the last thing, before going to bed. Being careful not to wake up the mate, whose room was opposite, I spoke in an undertone. He looked round anxiously. Can you get me a little hot water from the galley? I am afraid, sir, the galley fire's been out for some time now. Go and see. He flew up the stairs. Now, I whispered, loudly, into the saloon too loudly, perhaps, but I was afraid I couldn't make a sound. He was by my side in an instant. The double captain slipped past the stairs through a tiny dark passage. A sliding door. We were in the sail locker, scrambling on our knees over the sails. A sudden thought struck me. I saw myself wandering barefooted, bareheaded, the sun beating on my dark poll. I snatched off my floppy hat, and tried hurriedly in the dark, to ram it on my other self. He dodged and fended off silently. I wonder what he thought had come to me before he understood and suddenly desisted. Our hands met gropingly, lingered united in a steady, motionless clasp for a second. No word was breathed by either of us when they separated. I was standing quietly by the pantry door when the steward returned. Sorry, sir. Kettle barely warm. Shall I light the spirit lamp? Never mind. I came out on deck slowly. It was now a matter of conscience, to shave the land as close as possible, for now he must go overboard, whenever the ship was put in stays. Must. There could be no going back for him. After a moment I walked over to leeward, and my heart flew into my mouth at the nearness of the land on the bow. Under any other circumstances I would not have held on a minute longer. The second mate had followed me anxiously. I looked until I felt I could command my voice. She will weather, I said then in a quiet tone. Are you going to try that, sir? He stammered out incredulously. I took no notice of him, and raised my tone just enough to be heard by the helmsman. Keep her good full. Good full, sir. The wind fanned my cheek, the sails slept, the world was silent. The strain of watching the dark loom of the land grow bigger and denser was too much for me. I had shut my eyes, because the ship must go closer. She must. The stillness was intolerable. Were we standing still? When I opened my eyes, the second view started my heart with a thump. The black southern hill of Corin seemed to hang right over the ship like a towering fragment of everlasting night. On that enormous mass of blackness there was not a gleam to be seen, not a sound to be heard. It was gliding irresistibly towards us, and yet seemed already within reach of the hand. I saw the vague figures of the watch grouped in the waist, gazing in awed silence. "Are you going on, sir?" inquired an unsteady voice at my elbow. I ignored it. I had to go on. "Keep her full. Don't check her way." "That won't do now," I said warningly. "I can't see the sails very well," the helmsman answered me, in strange, quavering tones. Was she close enough? Already she was, I won't say in the shadow of the land, but in the very blackness of it, already swallowed up as it were, gone too close to be recalled, gone from me altogether. "Give the mate a call," I said to the young man who stood at my elbow as still as death. "ND turn all hands up." My tone had a borrowed loudness reverberated from the height of the land. Several voices cried out together. "ER all on deck, sir." Then stillness again, with the great shadow gliding closer, towering higher, without a light, without a sound. Such a hush had fallen on the ship, that she might have been a bark of the dead floating in slowly under the very gate of Erebus. "My God! Where are we?" It was the mate moaning at my elbow. He was thunderstruck, and as it were deprived of the moral support of his whiskers. He clapped his hands and absolutely cried out, "Lost!" "Be quiet," I said, sternly. He lowered his tone, but I saw the shadowy gesture of his despair. "What are we doing here?" "Looking for the land wind." He made as if to tear his hair, and addressed me recklessly. "She will never get out." "You have done it, sir." I knew it'd end in something like this. "She will never weather, and you are too close now to stay. She'll drift ashore before she's round. Oh my God!" I caught his arm as he was raising it to batter his poor devoted head, and shook it violently. "She's ashore already," he wailed, trying to tear himself away. "Is she? Keep good full there." "Good full, sir," cried the helmsman in a frightened, thin, childlike voice. I hadn't let go the mate's arm, and went on shaking it. "Eddie about, do you hear? You go forward shake, and stop there shake, and hold your noise shake, and see these head sheets properly overhauled shake, shake, shake." And all the time I dared not look towards the land lest my heart should fail me. I released my grip at last, and he ran forward, as if fleeing for dear life. I wondered what my double there in the sail locker thought of this commotion. He was able to hear everything, and perhaps he was able to understand why, on my conscience, it had to be thus close no less. My first order ardently re-echoed ominously under the towering shadow of Corin, as if I had shouted in a mountain gorge. And then I watched the land intently. In that smooth water and light wind it was impossible to feel the ship coming to. No. I could not feel her. And my second self was making now ready to ship out, and lower himself overboard. Perhaps he was gone already. ... The great black mass brooding over our very mastheads began to pivot away from the ship's side silently. And now I forgot the secret stranger ready to depart, and remembered only that I was a total stranger to the ship. I did not know her. Would she do it? How was she to be handled? I swung the mainyard and waited helplessly. She was perhaps stopped, and her very fate hung in the balance, with the black mass of Corin like the gate of the everlasting night towering over her taffrail. What would she do now? Had she way on her yet? I stepped to the side swiftly, and on the shadowy water I could see nothing except a faint phosphorescent flash revealing the glassy smoothness of the sleeping surface. It was impossible to tell, and I had not learned, yet the feel of my ship. Was she moving? What I needed was something easily seen, a piece of paper, which I could throw overboard and watch. I had nothing on me. To run down for it I didn't dare. There was no time. All at once my strained, yearning stare distinguished a white object floating within a yard of the ship's side. White on the black water. A phosphorescent flash passed under it. What was that thing? ... I recognized my own floppy hat. It must have fallen off his head. ... and he didn't bother. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.